So step nine is this. We made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Since I wasn't here last week, I was like, which people are we talking about? So we had to go back to step eight for a second. So step eight that Dustin taught last week was made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. So what Dustin was talking about last week in step eight was a willingness to address. Okay, so if you think about this in terms of AA, okay, this is like just kind of the extreme example. You're an alcoholic, and you've done a moral inventory, and you've taken care of, like, you've dealt with your stuff. At some point, once you've dealt with your stuff, then you need to step back and realize that everything that I do, my actions have consequences. The choices I've made, the decisions, the things I've done, that has consequences for my family and my close friends and my coworkers and the people around me. And step eight is the recognition that what I've done has had consequences on people, and there's a list of people who have been harmed by the things I've done. There are some sins, I suppose, that are just in our heads, but many of our sins, we like to think they're just in our heads, but they seep out into our actions. And so the effects of what we've done is played out on the people we love the most often. And so step eight was just this starting to think through, who are the people I've harmed? When I think of this activity in my life, here's who I've harmed, here's who I've done wrong, here's who I need to make amends to. It's not asking you to do that yet, it's just asking you to be willing and open to do that, all right? Which leads us back to where we're at this morning. We made direct amends to such people wherever possible, which is why I said a couple minutes ago that oftentimes people get to step nine, and this is a big gulp, right? It's one thing to make a list in my head of, here's the people in my life that I know I've wronged. That's one thing. But then to step out and say, I'm going to choose to sit down with those people and make amends for the things I've done. I don't know about the rest of you. This is terrifying. I hate to be the one to say I'm sorry first in my marriage, right? I know I should be, but I sure don't like it, right? And so this is hard. This is a really hard step. And depending on the wrongs, and for some of us, these things run deep. These things are things that we've done for years and years and years and years and years. And so that's what we're going to talk about this morning for a couple minutes. Now, if you start looking for bad apologies on the internet, there's a lot of great bad apologies on the internet, right? People who just specialize in, the guy in the bottom left, I don't know if you all know this guy, Chip Wilson. He was the guy, remember the yoga pants episode this year in the news? And his apology was basically like, I'm sorry, women, that your thighs are so fat that it wears out your yoga pants, right? Like, it was something along those lines was his apology. Like, he's an awful human being. Rob Ford. I mean, come on. This guy specializes in bad things. And then a Kanye. I mean, Kanye's been doing bad, you know, whatever. There's lots of bad apologies out there, right? And this book, a couple years ago, The Last Lectures, I remember this from Randy Pausch. He was a teacher at Carnegie Mellon, and he gave a lecture at the end of his life, and they made it into a book. And he has a whole chapter, and I love it. And he says this, a bad apology is worse than no apology, right? We've all been on the receiving end of that, right? We've been the person who somebody's wronged us. Just recently, I had a situation where somebody was apologizing to me, and they looked at the floor and said, I'm sorry, but this just kind of is the way it is. Well, I didn't feel like that was an apology at all. That felt like an excuse. Like, that didn't feel any better. In fact, it kind of feels worse at the end of the day, right? Let's be honest. We've all done this, right? We've all offered bad apologies. So let's just for a minute, what makes a bad apology? Give me the hallmarks of a bad apology. I'll put the people back up on the screen if you want to see them. All right? I'm sorry you feel that way. That is the worst, all right? I'm sorry that you have a problem. Yeah, Steve.
If it ends with but,
I'm sorry, but, you know, whatever excuse you have. Lack of sincerity. So just my kids excel at this. Say sorry to your brother. Sorry. There's no sincerity. And I'm not picking on my kids. Your kids do the same stuff, right? We do it to our spouses, let's be honest, right? Yeah. Yeah, to put blame. Or I'm telling you I'm sorry. I think you owe me an apology too, right? Like, that's kind of that goes right along with that. Like, that's not really an apology when you're really asking for one. What else? Anytime you're forced to. Well, yeah, like the kids. Say you're sorry. Sorry. That doesn't mean anything, right? So let's just, how many of us have been on the receiving end of a bad apology? All right? All of us, right? How does it make us feel? Terrible, right? How many of us have been on the giving end of a bad apology? Yeah, we've all done this too. I was thinking through examples, like, maybe I'll share some in a minute. I'll get there, all right? The beauty of this story, we don't do this story in church much because it's just a good kid story, right? Zacchaeus was a wee little man, a wee little man was he, climbed up in a sycamore tree for the Lord he wanted to see. But the funny thing about the kid's song is the kid's song ends right before the best part to me of the whole passage. Because the best part is, what it has to do with us here is if you look down at verse 8, but Zacchaeus stood up, oh, I got it on the screen. But Zacchaeus stood up and he said to the Lord, look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor. And if I've cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount. So the idea is that Zacchaeus is a tax collector. What he's doing is not illegal. What he's doing is not wrong. It's just not popular. He works for the Roman government. Now, remember, Jews see the Romans as their oppressors. They conquered us. They rule us. We don't like them. And Zacchaeus works for them. And he collects money from his people to give to their oppressor. And the way the job would have worked is he would have collected like 15% and paid the Romans 14%. I don't know what the numbers are, really. But that's how the job kind of worked. So being a tax collector is incredibly unpopular. It'd be like Canada invading us, and now I tell you all that I'm collecting taxes for the Canadians. That's a funny scenario. It's never going to happen. But that's kind of the idea, is that the people that oppress us, you're collecting money for them. So he's just not popular. But he sees, at least in this moment, as the people are kind of upset that Jesus is at his house, he recognizes that, and he's trying to make amends. And so he starts with, I'm going to give half my possessions to the poor. Think about that right now. Think about your bank account, the value of your house, the value of your cars, your 401k. Think of all of it. And imagine right now, I'll give half of that to the poor. Zacchaeus is serious about the making amends stuff right here. And then beyond that, if I've cheated anyone out of anything, if I've been unfair in my business dealings, those people I'm going to do four times. I will make it right. I know I've wronged them. I'll do the right thing. Okay? Really incredible. We get so hung up on his shortness and we miss this moment that's so, so big. So what does it mean then to make direct amends? Well, last week Dustin talked about the willingness to make amends. And in a couple minutes, Jeff is going to come up and Jeff is going to talk about keeping accounts short. But what does it look like? What's the space between those? Well, first of all, to make a good apology, we've got to start with getting specific. I don't know, maybe I'm the only guy in the room that's done this, but sometimes in my marriage, I don't want to say I'm sorry, but I want to get credit for being the person to say I'm sorry first. But I don't really want to own what it is that I did. So I say something like, well, I'm sorry for whatever I did that upset you, right? You're clearly upset, and whatever I did, I'm sorry. I well know. I know what I did, right? But I just want to get credit for the sorry without having to actually own the sorry, right? I'm the only one, right? You're all looking at me like I'm an alien, all right? So, okay, I'll just keep confessing. So anyway, so I make these vague apologies. If we're going to make direct amends, we've got to move beyond the vague apologies and get really, really specific. I'm sorry that I raised my voice to you. I'm sorry that I didn't show up when I said I was going to show up. For some of us, when we start thinking, and we're thinking about right now, Jeff's going to talk about keeping accounts short, but I'm talking about even maybe some things as we think back into our past, there are people that we owe apologies to. This might require several sessions. It might require a, I'm sorry for this. Let's walk through this thing. Now, I'm sorry for this. And we got to walk through them one by one. We're going to have to talk about in very, very specific ways exactly what it is that I did wrong. Okay? Saying I'm sorry that you're upset isn't going to work. Saying I'm sorry for, you know, whatever this vague thing is, isn't going to work. And then I need to demonstrate an understanding of the offense. Now, my wife makes me watch a television show that mostly I hate. It's called Parenthood. And I can tell you all the reasons I hate it. But I watch it with her anyway, mostly so I can critique it, which really annoys her. And then I don't apologize. Because I am not sorry. I don't know if we're current. I think we're several, maybe some episodes behind. Or maybe we are current. I don't know. But the character that Ray Romano plays, he plays a middle-aged man who has Asperger's. And he's meeting with his counselor, and they're talking about relationships and how the challenge for somebody with Asperger's is they don't understand other, they have a hard time understanding other people's emotions. They have a hard time understanding how their actions impact other people and how other people feel. And so his counselor, this was actually a really good part of the show, despite everything else I make fun of. This part was really, really good, that he was trying to help the character demonstrate an understanding of the offense. And the challenge being for somebody with Asperger's, that's very, very difficult. I think that's a really big part of making direct amends. Of doing our best to demonstrate that I understand why this upset you. This is what my kids really miss sometimes when they throw an I'm sorry out real fast. They don't demonstrate to their brothers, and I wish they would. I'm sorry that I pushed you down and made you bleed, right? I know that hurts. To demonstrate that they understand what they did, and they never do that part. They just say they're sorry and they want to go play again. What I hope as they get older is that they're able, when they make apologies, to demonstrate to the person I'm apologizing to that I understand why this hurt you. I'm not just being forced. I'm not going through this. I'm not just going through the motions because I know it's the right things to say, but I'm saying this because I recognize the hurt I caused you. Does that make sense? And then to take responsibility. I was wrong when I, and again, this goes back to a very specific thing, and we said some of these things. I'll move quickly through them. No excuses, no justifications, no minimizing. I'm sorry that I didn't pick you up from school on time, but all your friends were there, so it was really good, right? Like Steve said, any apology that we throw but on the end of doesn't work, right? So, and this is really, really hard. Okay, back to my marriage. It's really hard for me to say, I was wrong when I da-da-da, and then stop. Because I like to talk, and I like to keep talking, and I want to let her know how she wronged me as well, right? It's really, really challenging for us. And if you look at those people who do bad apologies in our culture, there's all this stuff, right? Everybody has a hard time stopping with, I was wrong when I, boom, done. We always feel like we have to give the reasons, the justifications to minimize the pain and the impact. And so a good apology, when we make direct amends, we're specific, we demonstrate our understanding of the offense, we take direct responsibility. And then one of the things we're trying to work on with our kids is to offer a step towards restitution. How can I make this up to you? One of the things we're trying to say to our boys often when they're in conflict with each other, which never happens with four boys, is we try to say to them, go make it right. It's not just about saying you're sorry. It's not just about getting the words out, but it's about making it right. Of doing whatever you can to repair the relationship. Because that's what this is all about, right? Making direct amends, this step in the 12 steps, this step in spirituality, is about making us relationally okay again. Now, I want to say something. Sometimes the hurts are so deep that this doesn't happen the first time we sit down with somebody. Sometimes the hurts we've caused are so deep that this doesn't ever happen. But at least on our end, we need to offer the step. An example, about a month ago, I was meeting someone from the church for lunch. He's not in here. I was meeting somebody for lunch, and apparently I put the wrong time on my calendar. He thought we were meeting at 11:30. I thought we were meeting at noon. And so I showed up at the place at noon, and he had showed up at the place at 11:30. And then I looked around the restaurant, and I didn't see him because he was kind of behind this wall. And so I went and sat down on the other side of the wall waiting for him to show up. And so then about like 12:20, so for 20 minutes, we were sitting on the opposite sides of a wall from each other. And then about 12:20, he walked out. And I was like, well, where'd you come from? And he's like, we were supposed to meet at 11:30. And so I did this thing, right? I'm wrong. I had the wrong time in my calendar. I am so sorry that you just sat and had lunch by yourself. I understand that that stinks. And so then I offered a step towards restitution. Let's meet next week. Breakfast is on me, right? Simple, easy. That's an easy example. But that's the kind of thing what we're after is, what's the restitution step? Now, we need to be careful in our culture, because our culture, we tend to think that everything, money solves every problem, and it doesn't. Hence, we believe that if you run over my toe, you now owe me $40 million, right? We think that everything should be a straight line to, oh, now I get to be a millionaire. You wrecked my car. Millionaire. And that's not, these most often, and sometimes that happens in business settings, and they're, you know, GM should pay some money, right? But here, this step is about, most of the time, you know, I can't say to my wife, I'm sorry that I wronged you. How can I make this right? She doesn't say, $50. 300. You know, like, maybe you all do that. I think it's weird. And oftentimes it's the fact that I went through these steps that's enough. Most of the time, in most of our daily relationships, this is enough just to have done it. But sometimes there's ways that we need to. So if I say to my kid, I'm going to be somewhere and I'm not, then maybe I need to make it up to him by taking him somewhere else and spending some time in another way and make actual restitution. My slides just went blank. Can you click me to the next one? I just have a blank screen here. The exception. In the step that we're on today, AA is really, really smart at this point because there's an exception here. So we made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Except when to do so would injure them or others. So there are offenses. There are people in my life, and there's people probably in all of our lives where we think of that person and we know the thing we did. And we dread to see them coming because we know that thing we did. And we know that it still hangs between us. And we know it's like a weight on our back that we can't deal with. And we need to make it right. But then there's these other things where I know I've done wrong by somebody and they just have no idea. I've had some really evil thoughts about you, Mike Tunis. Kidding, I haven't. How can you not love the beard? What's that? So the idea here is that there are things. So let's say, let's just use that. Let's say that I've had this like real burning anger towards Mike for months now, which I have not, all right? Let's say that I've had this burning thing inside of me, but Mike is blissfully unaware. What this is saying is this is not the place for me to sit down and go to Mike and say, let me tell you all the problems I have with you people, right? That's not this, because to do so injures him. He wasn't aware of what was going on. It wasn't causing problems in that way. It's like this. When I was a youth pastor, I would tell my high school boys, you know, you should do this. You should not go tell a woman that you had lustful thoughts about her. Not cool. Like, that injures somebody. That puts thoughts in their heads that they don't need to worry about. You need to deal with that thing. And I think in the AA context, what's really good here is this is where your sponsor or a good friend of somebody that's journeyed through it, maybe I need to sit down with somebody and say, man, I've been really struggling with my thoughts about Mike and he doesn't know it, but I need to work through these steps. Not in a gossipy way, but in a confessional kind of way. I need a confessor. I need somebody that I can say, I've been wrong in this. I'm going to take responsibility. I need to make it right, because what Mike doesn't know is I've been avoiding him. I haven't asked him out to coffee because I'm avoiding him and I need to make it right. I need to go do this. Mike doesn't need to know every detail of what's going on here. Now, there's other things. If I walked up and punched Mike in the face, well, then Mike knows this and Mike needs to know, you know, I need to sit down with Mike and have a conversation, right? Right? Yeah. Unless I'm really weak and he didn't even notice when I punched him in the face. Go to the next slide. Richard Rohr says this: you need to pray and discern about what the other needs to hear and also has the right to hear. What people want to hear in salacious and gossipy detail has now been fed by our media-saturated society, and our wanting to know has become our right to know. We don't need to know every detail. We think we've got to know every detail. Every time there's a scandal, we think we have to know every salacious, gossipy little detail about every little event. And the truth is, we just don't need to know. There are things that we need to confess to each other. There's ways that we need to make direct amends to each other. But even then, we don't need to give the person we're making amends to every detail of our thought process about this whole event. We need to be careful and we need to be wise. And that's where a sponsor or a pastor or a good friend or somebody or a spouse can help us navigate. And that's why sometimes I've read people, when they talk about making direct amends, that you should write it out in advance, that you should write down what you're going to say. And maybe for some of us to write down, I'm not going to say, I don't need to go into this level of detail about these things. Next slide. Truth is not just what happened, but also what you or any party has a right to know and can handle responsibly. For an addict, a gay person, a person with a pre-existing physical ailment, there are people who have a right to that knowledge, and frankly, people for whom it is none of their business, and there are people who will misuse it. We need to be wise about what we say and to who we say it to, that we're not just in under the banner of, I'm just making direct amends, we don't cause more carnage than there was already. We're trying to minimize carnage here, right? Not accelerate it, not add to it. Next slide. You know, people are texting me this morning. Why are they doing this? That's what's screwing up my slides. So, step 9, we make direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. A couple years ago, I lost a lot of weight. You all watched it. About 35 pounds, 30, I think it was 39 pounds, into my weight loss back in 2012. It was a really beautiful spring day, and the kids were at school. It was a Friday afternoon, and Jennifer and I decided to go on a walk, and so I got out my backpack. And I decided to fill my backpack with all the weight I had lost. So I stood on the scale, and she started adding rocks until I got to 39 pounds of weight in my backpack. And then we went on a hike. And I lasted a mile before I had to take off my backpack and chuck it because it was so uncomfortable and it was so heavy and my back hurt after walking a mile in the 39 pounds that I was carrying. The cool part was when I took it off after that mile, I felt like I was bouncing as I walked. Like, it was awesome. But you just don't notice. When you get that, when you get overweight like that, for me, you don't notice how much the weight actually is until you start to think about it. When somebody says, this is what 10 pounds is, and this is what you're carrying every day. And for me, that moment was so huge. Like, I'm carrying 39 pounds in my backpack, and my knees hurt after walking a mile. How did I live like this? I just can't do that anymore. And for some of us, this thing right here, we're carrying stuff in our backpack, and we have people that walk down the hallway at work, and we have family, and we have stuff, people even maybe in our church, where when they come walking down the hall, it's like a backpack filled with rocks, right? And we know that there's these things that hang between us that we have to do something about. And when I thought about this step, I thought about it really in terms of like that part of what this step is it's taking off the backpack and taking out the stuff that's inside. It's reaching in, this is really heavy, and taking out big rocks that some of us have been carrying these around for years and years and years. And what this step is about taking the rocks out of the backpack. I don't know if you've had this experience, but when you and your spouse, let's say, are in conflict, and then one of you has the courage to do this, and the weight that just lifts off the relationship, like, oh, I get crazy when my relationships are out of balance. I just do. And when we can do this with each other, when I can say I'm sorry, and without asking for it, she says it back, and we can make amends to each other, and things are good, it's like taking big rocks out of my pack and just setting them down and going, ah, oh, we're back. It's good. So this morning, what I want to invite you into is we're going to go into a time of just silence. And I'm going to ask you, during this Lenten season, we've given up some of our material possessions so as to put ourselves in a spot where we can hear from God more clearly. And maybe there's a person that as I've been talking, or maybe in the silence, there's a face that just comes to your mind. Like, this person, I've been carrying this thing with this person for a long time. And I need to go to the person and I need to get really specific about, I'm sorry when I was wrong. I understand how it made you feel. Is there anything I can do to make this relationship right again? So we're going to have some silence, and then Jeff is going to lead us in the next teaching. Let me pray us into the silence. I think Zach's going to play during the silence, actually. God, I don't know about everybody else in the room, but I get crazy when there's just stuff between me and people, and it does really feel like a backpack full of rocks we're carrying around. And God, I pray that you will give us the courage. This is a big step. This takes a lot of guts to look another person in the eye and say, I'm sorry, I was wrong, without offering excuses. And so God, I pray that you would move in us, that you would challenge us, that you would show us those people, and then give us incredible amounts of courage to have these hard conversations. And when we do, God, I pray that there will be a release, that we'll feel as if rocks are being taken out of a backpack for us. In your name I pray.
My name's Jeff. I think it's funny to start this series anytime talking just by saying, hi, my name is Jeff, and I'm anonymous, or whatever. Okay, so Charlie just talked about step 9, which is basically taking care of that big thing. I can't even pick that up with one hand. Mostly because it's awkward, not because it's too heavy. I'm pretty strong. So he just talked about the big thing that you need to that you've been thinking about, that big situation, that big whatever that is taken out of the bag. So that's good, and then we've been working up to that. And so I'm what happens next forever. That's what this is. So this is an ongoing, we continue to take a personal inventory. Continue to take implies that it's continuing to happen. That's why the word continued is in there. We continue to take a personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. So that's really easy, actually. This is step X. Okay. In other words, if we remove the garbage promptly, the house won't stink. So Charlie's thing is, like, if the foundation is terrible, the house will fall. This is, if there's a poopy diaper or chicken bits in your garbage that's been there for a little while, and then you walk in the house and it's like, oh my goodness, this smells terrible, what happened in my house? And you're like, oh yeah, it's the garbage, and you take it out. Because the house has begun to stink because there's a little bit of garbage in there. And it could be a little, like, I know this is kind of gross if you don't have kids, but it could be just like a really little piece of poop in a diaper that's at the bottom of the garbage can. And 3 days later, you walk in, you're like, what happened in here? And it's just this little thing, okay? That's a gross picture, but it's true. Anyway, so that's what this step is about, taking out the garbage when the house starts to stink. Implying that there's a house, at least. So this is from Leviticus. We're going to read Leviticus, but I'm going to kind of set a little bit of groundwork for Leviticus. I didn't do this for the last service, and I got a lot of, like, skeptical looks because I said some things that people are like, well, I've never heard that before, because no one's ever read Leviticus before. If you haven't, raise your hand. It is okay. When I heard step 10, I heard Leviticus, and I know that I'm unique in that in a lot of ways, but I just took a class. I'm in seminary, took a class on Leviticus, and so it was actually natural for me to think of Leviticus because I've been studying it. So we're going to read this, but first, I'm going to read a little bit from Leviticus to explain a little about what's going on. So in Leviticus, there's this whole sacrificial system thing that you probably have heard about, and you decided to start reading Leviticus. Yeah, I'll read Leviticus, and you hear verse 1 or 3. If the offering is a burnt offering from the herd, you are to offer a male without defect. You must present it at the entrance to the tent, and you fell asleep, and you quit, and decided that you weren't going to read Leviticus again. So I'm going to get just 3 chapters in, because you haven't gotten that far yet, and explain a little bit about what the sacrificial system was for, okay? Because that's going to make sense later. So here, just in general, this is, if any of you, if any member of the community, normal person, human being, sins unintentionally and does what is forbidden in any of the Lord's commands, when they realize their guilt, and the sin they have committed becomes known, they must bring as their offering for the sin they committed a female goat without defect. Why? I don't know. They are to lay their hand on the head of the sin offering and slaughter it at the place of the burnt offering. Then the priest is to take some of the blood with his finger and put it where, do you think? This is actually a question. Where do you think the blood's put? You think on the sinner, right? On you. No. That's the point. This is a big point that I'm going to make. So the blood, he takes the blood with his finger and puts it on the horns of the altar of burnt offering. And they pour the rest of the blood at the base of the altar. They remove the fat and they burn it, and it's a pleasing aroma to the Lord. In this way, the priest will make atonement for them, and they will be forgiven. And that's Leviticus. Okay, so I'm going to read this part now. If anyone sins in that he hears a public adjuration to testify, and though he is a witness, whether he has seen or come to know the matter, yet he doesn't speak, he shall bear his iniquity. This is going to be a long list of people that sin, okay? And this one is specifically, if you know something and you're in court and you don't say it, that wasn't good. Okay, next one. If anyone touches an unclean thing, whether a carcass of an unclean wild animal or a carcass of an unclean livestock or a carcass of unclean swarming things, this is Leviticus, this is why we go, oh, I don't want to read that. And it is hidden from him and he has become unclean and he realizes his guilt. Or... If he touches human uncleanness, of whatever sort the uncleanness may be, with which one becomes unclean, and it is hidden from him. It kind of reminds me, actually, of talking to you. Like, this reminds me of a conversation with Ryan Mitchell that I might have. Like, we're justifying every single little word. And it is hidden from him when he comes to know it and realizes his guilt, or if anyone utters with his lips a rash oath to do evil or to do good, any sort of rash oath that people swear, and it's hidden from him, when he comes to know it and realizes his guilt in any of these, when he realizes his guilt in any of these, it's repeated because it's important. When you realize your guilt, you confess your sin. He confesses the sin he has committed. He shall bring to the Lord as his compensation for the sin that he has committed a female from the flock, a lamb or a goat, for a sin offering. And the priest shall make atonement for him for his sin. I thought of this, because I'm so weird. When I heard step 10, I thought of this. When you do something you don't even know that you did, and then you realize you did it, you confess it. It's the little, ongoing, personal inventory thing. I don't even know that I touched this in a Levitical scenario. So there's a dead camel, and my ankle touched it as I was walking by it. I don't know why I was walking by a dead camel, but it touched it. And I didn't even know that I touched it, and then I will think back on my day, and I'm like, you know, there was a dead camel, and I did feel something tickle my ankle, and you realize that you've become unclean according to Levitical law. You confess that, and then you make it right. That's why I thought of it. So I've already told you a lot of the things that I think you need to know. One is that the sacrificial blood is not put on you to make you clean. It cleanses the tabernacle of the thing that you did. So in the ancient Near East, there's this belief that Charlie mentioned that there is like a miasma, which is a really cool word that means nothing to you. So what it actually means is that sin goes viral, and it goes in the air, and it hovers over the community. And what Leviticus is about is taking care of the tabernacle, because the tabernacle is the house of God in the ancient Near East. The glory of God is in the tabernacle. And you know what the glory means? I think I've said this a couple of times. The glory of God is the tangible presence of God on earth, is there. So when we sin, it affects the tangible presence of God on earth, if we are ancient Hebrews, okay? And so we make a sacrifice, and the blood is for cleansing the presence of God. It's not for cleansing you. You will be forgiven because you confessed, but that's not what that's about. Just wanted you to know that. Okay, I think that's interesting. We have this kind of idea in our relationships. Charlie already kind of brought up the scenario of, let's say I'm at dinner with my wife and we're sitting at a restaurant because that's where you eat dinner at, not at home, obviously, and because who would eat dinner at home? In America. So anyway, so we're sitting at a restaurant and we're having dinner and there's something wrong. And neither of us know if we did it, but we feel like there's something that's messed up. And you're like, I feel this. I know you feel this, but you don't even say those things. You just have that emotional thing that goes like, and you're like, I know. And like, it's just awkward and awful. And then eventually you bring it up. You're like, I don't know if it's me or if it's you. I don't know what's going on, but I feel like there's something there. And you talk about it. We say that we're clearing the air. In the same way, the sacrifice in Leviticus is clearing the air over the community to make sure that God doesn't leave, because he eventually does in the story. He leaves. The presence of God leaves the tabernacle. In Ezekiel, he does. There was a legitimate fear, and it actually happened. So even more legitimate fear. And then I want to apply this even a little bit more before I go on to reading a couple of quotes. So we talk about the glory as the tangible presence of God. When you sin, do you feel, just for yourself, as maybe, let's use a Pauline word, that we are the temple, right? Okay, so if we are the temple, we are where the presence of God, the tangible presence of God resides in us, which I think it does. When you sin, do you feel like there's something messing with that tangible presence of God in you? I feel like this isn't even the worst analogy. It's actually one of the best. I was just thinking about it later, and I was just like, this is really good. Okay, so there's a picture of the tabernacle. You're welcome for that. Actually, I'll let you look at that for a little bit longer if I can. I don't know. I think my phone's slow. I bought it through Walmart. Maybe that's why. There we go. Okay. Moving on. So this is a commentary. Most people don't read commentaries. Actually, I don't think anyone on the internet has read this commentary because I tried to look up an image of this book, and it doesn't exist on the entire internet, which is really big, I heard. There wasn't a picture, so I took one. This is with my phone. I took a picture because I wanted a picture of the book, and that's why it's a terrible picture. Okay. This is by a guy named Samuel Ballantyne. It's about Leviticus. This is something that I think is interesting. At the personal and communal level, sin disrupts the relationship with God with bad faith acts that obstruct God's capacity to be present in the lives of people who have been created for blessing and purpose. I'm going to read that one more time because it's a lot of really wonderful words putting together into a wonderful sentence. At the personal and communal level, sin disrupts the relationship with God with bad faith acts that obstruct God's capacity to be present in the lives of people who have been created for blessing and purpose. That's what sin does. In priestly theology, sin's corruption is not limited to people. Instead, it's like a virus released into the world that attacks and breaks down societies and institutions. Somebody brought up to me earlier that we often don't think that our personal sin is as bad as those five guys on the screen that had the bad apologies. We don't think of us as having that problem. We know that other people's sin affects like big societal things. We know that, but we don't think of our own things as being that big. And at least the Old Testament thinks that it is. Pictures. More serious still are the sins of the faith community, for they corrupt and defile the sanctuary where God would be present. Because the sanctuary symbolizes on earth God's creational plan for the entire cosmos, its defilement threatens God's departure not from the local community only, but also from the whole world. It's serious stuff. So this is what this step is about. It's about taking an ongoing inventory, about taking the unconscious thing that we do and bringing it to the conscious level, paying attention to what's going on every day. I spent about 3.5 months writing a blog every day. It was like my daily blog as opposed to my daily bread. And I was just writing about something that happened that day and what I think I might have learned from it. That's something. But sometimes that's not me acknowledging all of the bad things that I do. So this is almost, in AA language, is taking an inventory at the end of the day. Like, what did I do? And what do I need to make amends for today? An ongoing thing, so that the small thing doesn't become a really big thing. Bringing the unconscious things to the consciousness. That's what the Leviticus passage is about, in my opinion. Recognition of the effect of your actions on those around you. Knowing that you and the things that you do affect everyone else's ability that's in relationship with you to experience God at the deepest level possible. I think it's true. It's not a hypothesis. I actually do think it's true. When we're messed up, the people that we're in the closest relationships with also have a messy relationship with God because of the things that we're doing to mess that relationship up. This is where I want to turn the corner a little bit in this whole series, because when we make amends is always something that the bad person or the person that did the bad thing does. Like, it's always that action. I sinned. I'm making amends. But when I hear amends, I don't know if you hear this, it's like putting something back together. And that's not always the case, right? It's not always the case that I sinned, I decide I'm going to make amends, I say I'm sorry, I ask for forgiveness, I own it all the way, I don't make any excuses, and the relationship isn't mended, right? I didn't fix the relationship, it's just I put myself out there. And that's what step 10 is about. And I think step 9 and step 8 and all of this is about that. But what Jesus is about, is there like something's falling on the roof? We shall hurry so we don't die. So what was just the gospel passage that was read was Peter asking Jesus, how many times should I forgive the person that sins against me? 7 times? Which I think is like, wow, Peter, you're really holy. You want to do it 7 times. And Jesus, in the one that we read, was 77 times. And the one that I read this week is 70 times 7 times, which is 490 times. And it doesn't matter. The point that Jesus makes is you forgive. And he makes it after the Lord's Prayer. We pray, forgive us our debts as we forgive those who have sinned against us or whatever. I just changed all of those words. And then at the end, when Jesus like closes the quotation marks, then he says, because if you forgive the people who sin against you, God will forgive you. And if you don't, God won't forgive you. And then at the end of this one, he says, because if you forgive the people that sin against you, God will forgive you. And if you don't, he won't. Jesus says this a couple times, and we're like, we don't believe that, right? We don't actually believe it in practice because we don't forgive people who sin against us. But that's what Jesus says is going to happen, which means forgiveness is a big deal, which means forgiveness is a big part of this as a church community, that we are going through a similar process of being willing to forgive when someone's willing to make amends. That's something that I learned from Jeff and Joan Keach. They're in the Al-Anon program. This step in Al-Anon, or not this step necessarily, I don't think is step 8, is getting to the point where you're willing to receive and offer forgiveness to the person who's finally reached the point where they're making amends with you. That part of this, part of mending the relationship, is being forgiving people. And that's what Jesus expects us to be, is forgiving people from your heart. That's what it says in Matthew 18. Not just like, yeah, it's cool. Like, genuinely forgiving people. I don't know what's on these. Men's, yep. I've talked about all of that stuff. So, anyway, let's beat a dead horse or let's not. So here's the point. We are all created in the image of God. We all have inherent dignity. And when we confess the things that we did, the small things that we did to somebody else, we are saying, I know that you as the human being that I love has been hurt and broken by me. And because I honor the image of God in you and I love you, will you forgive me? Or I'm sorry, will you forgive me? And then the person that's receiving that, knowing that we are created in the image of God, we have inherent dignity, that we're created as very good, says, because I love you and you have the image of God in you, I forgive you. That's what this is about. Honoring the inherent dignity that is within one another. I'm going to end with this. I've got like 4 more slides. I don't care. Because this bag has a bunch of small rocks in it, and I think it's a good final kind of a visual thing. So this is noticing the little thing and taking it out and saying, I'm really sorry about that. Because what happens, this bag is probably 4 or 5 pounds of small rocks in here. When they just kind of collect and we don't keep doing this ongoing personal inventory, I actually learned this is scientific. I told the last group it wasn't. It is scientific. It turns into this big rock. Again, it's not. It doesn't look like this because this is obviously just one rock. It's like one huge rock of little rocks, not Arkansas. The big rock that needs to be dealt with in a big way, that's harder to deal with, that's really stinking heavy. When we don't do this ongoing inventory, this is what we're working towards, is being at a point where we've dealt with the big thing and then we deal with the small thing so it doesn't become big things again. That's what this is about. As we come together to do communion, we're going to do the litany of penitence. So praying together about some certain things that we might be needing to confess to God. And then we'll do the Apostles' Creed. As you come up for communion, I want you to think about maybe there is somebody that you need to be looking at as restoring that relationship with, or being willing to forgive for the first time. And as you come forward for communion, I want you to think about that. Maybe take an action if you need to, if that person's close to you in the aisle or whatever. Do it. We don't ever talk about that here, but it's one kind of important thing just in life, is to do that. So here's your opportunity today to do that.